Welcome to another episode of the Left of Lansing podcast with Pat Johnston. A progressive insight into Michigan's political and cultural world. And of course, an entertaining podcast designed to shine a light on how to make Michigan's political machine work for the people. Now, from the Left of Lansing headquarters, located in his attic, here's the award-winning Pat Johnston.
Welcome to another installment of Michigan's premier progressive podcast. I am Pat Johnston, and let me quickly go back to last week's show if I can real fast, because it was awesome getting to talk with Democratic candidate for House District 51, Sarah Mae Seward. Now, Sarah's running against MAGA Michigan Republican insurrectionist and weird as blank Matt Maddock, who's only using his seat to collect a paycheck by us. He's not there to help the people of Michigan, and he's certainly not there to help the people of his district. Well, weirdo MAGA Matt Maddock just cannot resist from showing how bat-crap insane he really is. He tweeted this week, "Who should be deported first, communists or invaders?" Boy, that Matt Maddock, what a funny guy. Look, he probably can't define communism, nor fascism for that matter, which is a shame since that's what he advocates on a daily basis. But as Sarah Mae Seward and I reminded everyone last week, he never deleted that racist and ridiculous tweet from last spring where Maddock believed that he unearthed the political scandal of scandals by sharing pictures of people getting off a plane at Detroit Metro Airport. No, according to Maddock, these weren't just people. No. They were illegal immigrants or invaders coming into the country. And worse, they were being flown in by Governor Gretchen Whitmer. Panic, everybody, panic! Of course, it turned out it was the Gonzaga men's basketball team deplaning for their NCAA tournament game that was taking place in Detroit that night. But see, to Matt Maddock, some of those players were people of color, so to him, they just had to be bad. And that's the guy representing parts of Oakland County. I refuse to believe that people of Oakland County are like that. I refuse to believe that. They can do better with someone like Sarah Mae Seward. And this week, Sarah shared on her social media page how many of her campaign yard signs are being ripped out and replaced by Maddock signs. She said he hasn't even won his primary yet, but he's already scared. Good. I agree with you, Sarah. He is scared. Also, the Detroit News of all places, is endorsing Sarah Mae Seward over Matt Maddock, calling him a bully who adds no value to the legislature. Hey, give credit where and when credit is due. Good job, Detroit News. And let me just say this too, quickly, that I've also had yard signs vandalized. I've also had yard signs ripped apart, thrown out into the street. I think back in 2022, I had a Whitmer for Governor sign that was out. One morning I woke up and there it was in the road. Okay, I just grabbed it, put it back on those little metal posts. And while it was a little crumpled up, a little beat up, I proudly put it right back on there. And then a couple days later, it was ripped out again. But I put it right back up again. But these people are such snowflakes. These MAGA people are snowflakes. Don't give in to them. They try to use intimidation. They try to bully you. Don't let them do that. Bullies are always the weak ones. Okay, for the first time, the show is going to be a little different this week because I will have two guests on. That's right. Kind of excited about it. And yes, I'll continue with the traditional Left of Lansing last call, which will be about a crucial decision that came down in favor of working Michiganders that was handed down by the Michigan State Supreme Court this week. So stay tuned for that later on. But coming up here in just a moment, I'm so thankful she could spare a few minutes to talk with us this week. Susan Demas from Michigan Advance will be on to talk about how Michigan is suddenly filled with vice presidential buzz. Yeah. That's right, we're hearing not one, but now two names from Michigan in this vice presidential buzz talk. Be it Governor Whitmer or Democratic U.S. Senator Gary Peters? Huh? Michigan is making some news, and I wanted to talk to Susan about it, not only because she's got her ear to the ground when it comes to Michigan politics after covering it for a number of years, but because she also wrote a piece in Michigan Advance called "Why Not Whitmer?" And then in the second segment, I'll talk with Jared Yates Sexton because he wrote an insightful piece a week ago about what he says is the most important story of the 2024 election, but it's a story that's not really being covered, and that's the tie between MAGA and tech fascism. I'll share his Substack article on leftoflansing.com and also where you're listening to the podcast, including on YouTube. Don't forget that I'm putting videos on there now that are not part of the podcast or part of the Friday short or the Monday musing. So please subscribe to Left of Lansing on the YouTube as well as the podcast itself. All right, Vice President Kamala Harris's campaign officially kicked off this week in Atlanta, Georgia. Listen.
Well, Donald. I do hope you'll reconsider to meet me on the debate stage. Because as the saying goes, if you've got something to say,
just listen to that excitement in the crowd, and it's reverberating across the country as yours truly predicted it would. But there's something or someone else who also electrifies the Democratic base. Listen.
Now, my grandma always said I needed to find at least one good thing about every person. And so I'll give JD this. He is efficient. In one sentence, he insulted women, black people, and Jewish people. That's efficient. And that's all I got.
And that was, of course, Michigan Democratic Governor Gretchen Whitmer at a Pennsylvania rally. And she was just being herself, which the people also simply love. And watching that speech, I wondered, why not Whitmer for vice president? And you know what? Sometimes in our cosmos, great minds think alike. And that's why I wanted to have editor-in-chief of Michigan Advance, Susan Demas, on the show this week, because she actually wrote an awesome piece titled Why Not Whitmer? And after reading Susan's column this week, I remain more than convinced that Whitmer would probably be the best pick as Harris's vice presidential candidate. So let's talk about that and more with Susan Demas. Susan, thanks so much for being on this week at last minute's notice. I greatly, greatly appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having me.
All right. Well, the speculation game is in hyper focus on exactly who will be Kamala Harris's running mate, especially with her campaign announcing she'll be making her first appearance with her VP pick in Philadelphia next week. That, of course, has many already guessing it's going to be Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro. However, the second stop is apparently happening in Michigan, which also happens to be Gretchen Whitmer's home state. And as some are pointing out, many past VP rollouts happened outside the VP pick's home state. All right, just remember that. So, Susan, despite Gretchen Whitmer's recent statement saying that she has absolutely zero interest in being Harris's running mate, do you think if she were asked, she would possibly say no?
No. And I say that because I believe that Gretchen Whitmer is a patriot. And if she were asked to serve her country, she would. I do believe that she has not been aggressively pursuing this. She intends to stay in Michigan. I think the biggest thing working against her is that I think it's just an abundance of caution. We have seen what happened when the first woman was nominated to a major party ticket, the presidency with Hillary Clinton. She lost a race a lot of people expected her to win. And the idea of doubling down in an all-female ticket in a race that suddenly seems very, very winnable. I can understand the people who are far smarter than I saying that would be a bridge too far. However, my argument is that we are living in a much different world than in 2016. We know what a Donald Trump presidency means, especially, you know, for women and people of color. And this is a post-Dobbs environment where a third of the country doesn't have access to basic health care for women. And who better to articulate that than an all-female ticket? Because they intimately know what kind of impact that has on all aspects of your life.
Well, and you address the concerns that Democrats do have about this all-female ticket. And you just, of course, just talked about how things have changed since 2016. I think all Democrats really have to do across the country is just look at the history of what happened here in Michigan. And I was wondering if maybe you could just share that, because in 2018, there were many people inside the Michigan Democratic Party who had reservations about not just having Whitmer at the top of the ticket, but other women running for statewide office in Michigan. And there were a lot of concerns there. So can you talk about that?
So right now, in hindsight, you know, we all know about those women from Michigan. They all won re-election by large amounts in 2022, but none of this was preordained. Back in 2018, it was 2 years after Hillary Clinton lost. You had people within the Democratic Party, especially on the union side of things, who are like, look, nobody's going to go for another female governor. Jennifer Granholm left office when she was unpopular, and Hillary Clinton just lost. We just need to find the best white guy we can. And they turned out to be wrong, because I don't think anybody else could have won that election by almost 10 points. We have really talented people in Michigan, but Whitmer has proven her appeal. And if she hadn't won the election by so much, we probably wouldn't have had a Democratic attorney general, because for her first election, Dana Nessel only won by 2 points, you know, so clearly the top of the ticket helped her. We've now gotten used to Gretchen Whitmer being on the national scene. She's been talked about for 2028. But in this particular election, where we're talking about only a few swing states in play and serious concerns about those blue wall states that Trump did win in 2016, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. I mean, you're hard pressed to find too many people that exude that kind of like upper Midwest sensibility than Gretchen Whitmer. I mean, Tim Walz of Minnesota seems to be giving it a run for his money. He's very endearing in the videos with his daughter, and I know he suddenly has a lot of support online. But, you know, Gretchen Whitmer, I think, has been a much more known quantity, and I think could bring in pretty much all the factions that Vice President Harris would need.
I'm with you on that. I'm on the exact same wavelength. And you know what? What made her a national name, because obviously we knew her here in Michigan, but let's be honest, is when Trump attacked her during the COVID pandemic. And what that did, though, was, I think, just show the rest of the country what we were seeing for the first couple of years, and actually even longer when she was in the state House and state Senate. And that was that her political and rhetorical skills combined with that central Michigan Midwest accent were exactly what I think people were craving for in a way during those MAGA Trump years. They saw a smart, savvy, younger voice, a Gen X voice. Not many of us on the Democratic stage, but even more, she was and has always been, I have always thought this too, even when she was in the state legislature, an effective politician in terms of messaging. And that's something that Democrats struggled for years doing, I thought. And I think she continues to show Democrats how to message and how to message well. And I think that's what does make her such an attractive candidate for the vice presidential ticket, maybe.
I mean, she is able to hold her own without really getting nasty. I mean, she really does not go negative. You know, she didn't call Trump an asshole. You know, she stuck to like, I want you to help the people I represent. She didn't make it a personal thing with him, even though he made it a very personal thing with her. But she didn't cower and just like suck up to him to get ventilators either, because that's not her style. She kind of has that Midwest nice disposition without being a pushover, which is a real hard line to walk, especially as a woman. And she's good at like tapping into things that people care about. I remember in 2018 interviewing some of her opponents in the Democratic primary, and they just laughed at the fix the damn roads thing. Like, we've got way bigger problems than that. This is dumb. And you know what? I understand we do have serious problems. We did then, we do now. But in Michigan, if you do spend any amount of time here, the roads are a problem. And they're a problem for business, for schools, for safety. Meeting people's basic needs is important, you know, and that's what her tenure during COVID was all about, making sure that we had tests, making sure that people had vaccines when they were available. If that's what people are really concerned about, you can't ignore that just because you personally think something is more important. You can walk and chew gum at the same time, which I think she's shown, especially now that she has a Democratic legislature where there is no priority left behind. It's not like she said, forget about it. We're not doing labor stuff. We're just going to do abortion rights. She did abortion rights. She did labor rights. She did gun control, energy policy, LGBTQ rights. She made sure that everybody had a seat at the table And that was something I think a lot of voters were looking for. And those of us who've been watching things for a while were pretty surprised that they pulled it off.
I guess that leads to my next question then, Susan. Is Whitmer pragmatic or progressive or both? Does she deserve all the credit for all of the progressive bills that she signed into law? Or did she also maybe at times kind of get pushed into signing those bills thanks to the Democratic majority in Lansing?
I think she's both. As somebody who covered her in the legislature, especially in the Senate for her entire tenure there, she was always known as, like, Republicans just rolled their eyes at her. She's just way too liberal. Yeah. She wants to be attorney general. She wants to be governor. She'll never get elected statewide. All she does is talk about abortion and gay rights. Nobody cares. And so that was really her reputation. And I think where people got the impression that she was extremely moderate was just that the dynamics in her 2018 primary, where you had two candidates that were really running Bernie Sanders style campaigns, that made her look like she was Hillary Clinton, even though she was to the left of that. As far as what she signed, I mean, I think we all know that she has been out in front on labor, women's rights issues, and LGBTQ issues. I think in terms of some of the other policies she signed, like energy legislation, I have no doubt that, you know, members of the legislature that have expertise in that, who wanted more progressive green policy, I'm sure they had a seat at the table. And that's an important give and take in government.
Then let's talk about quickly some concerns and liabilities when it would come to Gretchen Whitmer, because we're not here just to say, oh, she's always so awesome and all that. What would you say? What would you say would be some liabilities?
So I think that in covering her as long as I have, certainly in terms of being a presidential, vice presidential candidate, she does not have foreign policy. Yeah. I mean, I can imagine that she would make the case that she's the governor of a border state, but that's rather limited. That's definitely a liability. I do think that she is a politician and has made certain decisions based on acquiescing to what may be popular, like no-fault reform, some of her later COVID policies. I know, ironically, you know, she got the reputation for being too far in terms of COVID policy, but when we're in the middle of the Delta wave, by that point, we had no state restrictions, and it was like all up to the local governments. And believe me, in interviewing those folks, they weren't all that pleased with it. It was kind of a mess. So governors have to make choices sometimes. She's not afraid to do that. And you can make the case that she felt like those were moves she had to make for her reelection. And perhaps she was correct. But I think definitely those are some things that I think would be fair criticism. And in terms of being a running mate, she is not an attack dog. She's a very good debater. She's not going to take any guff. But if you want someone to go up there and to give a 20-minute speech about Trump being a jerk and Vance being weird, maybe she's not the best person for that, because that has not been her style. The 2022 gubernatorial election got extremely ugly with really deep personal attacks against her. I mean, Tudor Dixon, her Republican opponent, spent an entire day making fun of her for being kidnapped. That was what she did for a day in various events, along with Don Trump Jr. I honestly had never seen anything like that before. She questioned how sick Gretchen Whitmer's father was. Groups that supported her were calling her a groomer. The co-chair of the Republican Party was saying that Gretchen Whitmer wasn't as hot as their candidate. So, and Gretchen Whitmer never threw anything back like that. She'd make a joke, do a good one-liner, and then get back to her priorities, which is very effective if you're running for governor of a big state like Michigan that's very diverse, and it's damn hard to win by 11 points. But that may not be the right skill set for vice president, especially given who you're running against.
I think she benefited a little bit, too. I'm just going to keep it real that she did have to deal with Tudor Dixon, and who was not a very good politician at all. And I like your point there, is that I wonder if she would really be able to deal with somebody like a J.D. Vance on the stage. I have a feeling she'd be able to hold her own. But I see what you're saying about sometimes you need your vice presidential pick to be more of the red meat kind of person, right?
Right.
So then quickly, Michigan U.S. Senator, Democrat, Gary Peters' name now surfaces out of nowhere about being a possible dark horse candidate. Is this for real?
I haven't seen anything beyond just like he's being talked about. I haven't seen that he's actually being vetted. Interestingly, he did not bat it away and be like, oh, no, no, no. I mean, he clearly seems interested, but we're getting fairly late in the process since apparently this is all going to be announced in 6 days. So most of the speculation at this point is on Tim Walz, Josh Shapiro, and Mark Kelly.
What do you think?
You know, I put away my crystal ball a long time ago, but
okay.
I was thinking Walls. The Philadelphia location does give me some pause. It would be kind of weird for it to be somebody other than Shapiro when it's right there in his backyard. But then again, Philadelphia is a very important place for a Democrat to win.
Exactly. Well, Susan, listen, I thank you so very much for being on, editor-in-chief of Michigan Advance, my favorite publication when it comes to Michigan political news. Susan, thanks so much for your time. And if you don't mind, I might beg you to return one more time as we near Election Day, if that's okay.
Oh, thank you. That's so kind of you.
You're listening to LOL.
It's Michigan's premier progressive podcast, Left of Lansing with Pat Johnston. If Pat's brand of progressive pontifications is getting you all riled up and you'd like to give him a piece of your mind, or if you'd like to tell him he's doing an outstanding job and to keep up the great work, just email him. That's leftoflansing@gmail.com. Do you have stories you think Pat must know about or guest ideas for future episodes? That's leftoflansing@gmail.com. Want to share your thoughts on how to grow Michigan's population or which flavor of Faygo Pop is the best? It's rock and rye, by the way. Just email Pat, leftoflansing@gmail.com. Now, here's Pat.
Thanks, Jessica. And before I forget, I'd just like to thank my good friend Rich for all of his hard work on leftoflansing.com. Rich, we are all indebted to you. Okay, well, this is a topic I wanted to highlight here this week since it's something I believe needs more attention, more of a spotlight as we're getting engrossed in this rather ever-changing and crazy election year. And it's something that affects not only Michiganders, but everyone across the country and probably the world too. And I'm glad that writer and podcaster Jared Yates Sexton is on to talk about this in more detail from his Substack called Dispatches from a Collapsing State. Jared wrote a post last week titled, What's Actually at Stake? MAGA and Tech Fascism. It's an issue that Jared believes isn't getting enough attention, but it's key to understanding what this race is ultimately about and who in the tech industry is backing the MAGA effort for their own financial and authoritarian gains. Jared is also part of the Muckrake Political Podcast and is also author of the book called Midnight Kingdom, A History of Power, Paranoia, and the Coming Crisis. Jared, thank you so much for taking some time to appear on Left of Lansing this week. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Pat. And I'm really glad we're talking about something that's pretty important here.
Of course. Well, hey, since you are a fellow podcaster as well, how long, Jared, have you been working on the Muckrake Political Podcast, and what can listeners expect to hear week in and week out?
You know, I've got a weird origin story when it comes to politics, but I've been following this stuff for roughly the last decade. I kind of jumped into the deep end of the pool and had to figure out what was going on, which I think has given me a different perspective than what I think a lot of analysts and a lot of strategists are coming to this stuff with, you know, sort of a more deeper politics that aligns with the material conditions that are actually taking place as opposed to individuals and personalities. So basically what I'm trying to do is give historical and contextual analysis that goes a lot deeper than what you're getting most places, I think.
Is that the same for Dispatches from a Failed State?
Dispatches from a Collapsing State.
I'm sorry, Collapsing State. Sorry about that.
Listen, we're not a failed state yet, Pat. we're doing the work to try and knock this thing off. I'm a former academic, so I try and spend a lot of time I'm sort of scaffolding the information that I find. I'm trying to communicate it to groups of people that maybe don't have the specialties, they don't have the jargon. And so I'm trying to basically turn that into an educational sort of resource.
Gotcha. All right, well then let's talk about the article that I highlighted titled MAGA and Tech Fascism. It seems like the main player or the central player, whatever, in this merger is the one and only Ohio MAGA Republican U.S. Senator and now dear leader Trump's running mate, J.D. Vance. And you write, and I'm going to quote here, Vance is a dangerous, disgusting individual. His desperate need for power makes him a perfect conduit for an agenda that goes well beyond him. I'll give you the floor to talk about what exactly makes Vance this dangerous and disgusting individual that you described. But Jared, why is he also the perfect conduit, as you put it, for an agenda that goes beyond him? And, you know, why is this like flying over the heads of many in the corporate media world, or worse, maybe just being ignored by those in corporate media?
At the risk of understating how I feel about J.D. Vance, I believe he is one of the most truly most repellent and putrid politicians that we have seen in the modern era. This is a person who made his fortune and based all of his power on betraying his family, using them and his background and his story as a slingshot into this tech fascist atmosphere. He has betrayed everyone he has ever known. We're even seeing more and more examples of that. But also, he is not married in any way to any actual belief other than that he deserves power. As a result, he gained the attention of Peter Thiel, an anti-democratic tech billionaire who has given him every job, every funding, used him as a puppet. Him and Blake Masters were just these two absolutely disgusting attempts by Thiel to get a foothold in the Senate. Unfortunately, Vance made his way through. The problem here, and we're lucky in some regards, but the discourse and media coverage and analysis of all this is so shallow. It is so dangerously shallow. Like, we get caught up in how disgusting Vance is. And he is disgusting. The things he says about women, the things he says about gay people, the things he says about democracy writ large. He is disgusting. And so as a result, he gets all of this attention for his own personal peccadilloes and all these repellent things that he says. But the truth is, and our media is either unwilling or incapable of understanding the deeper material conditions here, which is that there is a massive contingent of tech oligarchs who are naturally disgusted by democracy. It makes rational sense that they do not respect it and they see it as an impediment on their own power and profit. And what has happened is that over the past couple of decades, they have been brought in as outsourced labor to carry out the work of empire in the United States of America. The military-industrial complex, when it comes to Musk, it's not just that. Of course, he is basically the entire space program. And so as that has happened, history tells us that every time these people start corrupting nation states, eventually they try and take over. And it makes rational, logical sense. And what has happened? You said merger. I have likened it to a feudal, monarchical, you know, noble marriage is what it is. Because in the past, you would take these two people from two different families that had certain power bases and a certain amount of profit and wealth between them, and you would bring them together in a political marriage in order to cement sort of the connection. And what has happened here is that Donald Trump has been bought off by the tech oligarchs behind J.D. Vance. And Trump, I don't think, actually understands any of this. He understands the money. He understands that they're going to give him technical assistance. He's happy with that. In that exchange, J.D. Vance has been named the heir apparent of the MAGA movement, which is a pseudo-populist authoritarian movement that is controlled by another group of oligarchs who have been destroying democracy for decades. But these tech oligarchs are now using J.D. Vance and their leverage with the Trump campaign in order to push an agenda that is literally one of the biggest threats to democracy that humanity has ever seen.
Before we talk more about these tech oligarchs, if you don't mind, if I just go off on this brief tangent. When it comes to J.D. Vance, I've been talking a lot about white Christian nationalism here on the podcast, especially for like the last year or so. But listening and reading more about him, I'm not necessarily picking up just a white Christian nationalist vibe to him. I'm picking up what I call like just bro culture vibes from him. I don't know. I was wondering what your take would be on that.
Well, first of all, I think that's astute. So one of the reasons that I hate J.D. Vance, and he is one of my biggest nemeses in the world, is I come from a culture much like J.D. Vance. I come from a working class culture in Indiana. And as a result, I see him as a class traitor, first and foremost. Second of all, what is happening here? And I think we have all these floating sort of labels and ideologies out there. Christian nationalism is one of them. And people don't understand what Christian nationalism is. But as an ex-evangelical who grew up in that community, I can tell you definitively, what it is not exactly a religion. It's a vehicle for authoritarian control. It's a story that people can get behind. Now, some of the Christian nationalists truly believe that Donald Trump has been minted by God, and as a result, They're fighting a battle between capital G good and capital E evil. There are many more of them like J.D. Vance or a Josh Hawley who see it as the vehicle to power. It's the story that makes the authoritarian push work. And that's what has always happened with authoritarian movements. They take a religion, they turn it into the story that helps them, including fascists, Nazis, you name it. Meanwhile, that bro culture that you have brought up, that is another leg of the authoritarian stool. It involves religion, but it also involves patriarchal control. And quite frankly, these people are so soft. And you know, you talk about Michigan, I talk about Indiana. The people that I have known who portray this hyper-masculinity, they're so soft and brittle, and that's the reason that they do it. And J.D. Vance is playing a character in order to push his agenda, which is expressly anti-liberal, post-liberal authoritarianism. They believe that democracy was a mistake. They trace all of their ideas back to a pre-Enlightenment period, and all of the other stuff are just vehicles and costumes and rhetorical appeals. Everything that actually matters to these people is just profit and power.
All right, well, then let's talk about his relationship then with Peter Thiel, just in case, you know, for some of my listeners that may not exactly be following J.D. Vance's career and all that stuff and know the name Peter Thiel. Can you talk about him in some detail?
Yeah, I'll try and do it without becoming nauseous. Peter Thiel is one of these tech oligarchs who made his money in creating, you know, it helps because when you start talking tech, let's be honest, Pat, your eyes start getting heavy and they start rolling back in your head, right? Like, we use these things, we don't want to understand them. It's a very, you know, sort of a closed off subculture. It's easier to think about the industrialists of the 20th century, the robber barons, mm-hmm. the ones who controlled oil and building materials and transportation. This is a new era of industrialists. It just so happens that these are the ones who laid the foundation for the tech industrial revolution. So what has happened is that Thiel and Elon Musk and a bunch of other people, Anderson, you name it, these people have coalesced together and they have come together under the umbrella of a weird group of esoteric ideas. And listen, I know there are going to be people who hear this and they're like, is this seriously what they believe? And I promise you, if you go and watch their speeches, you read their books, their articles, all of it, they say it expressly. What they have is a strangely esoteric, white supremacist, patriarchal, authoritarian agenda. And, you know, someone like Thiel could not be elected because they're so strange and they're so alienating. And so what they do, and this has been the way that these industrialists have always worked, is they always handpick sort of their puppets that they push forward. And again, J.D. Vance was joined by Blake Masters. It just so happened that Arizona repelled from him like so much spoiled milk. And J.D. Vance just happened to have a winning electoral hand dealt to him in Ohio. But Peter Thiel is one of the movers and the shakers behind the scenes who is manipulating these material conditions for his own ends.
You mentioned the name Elon Musk. He bought Twitter knowing that even if he takes a substantial financial loss, that it's worth it to him because it allowed he and his people to control the messaging. And I can't tell you how much my algorithms have changed and how certain people are getting shadow banned that I used to always follow. And I could rely that, you know, they'd pop up on my wall when I'd open up Twitter. They're not there hardly anymore. And now I'm also ending up, you know, coming across all these far right wing racist garbage posts on my wall now more than ever. But I mean, that was the ultimate goal for Elon Musk, right?
Oh, that's absolutely right. And you know, Twitter, and I will not call it X just for the record. Mm-hmm. Twitter is really misunderstood. Everyone thought it was just sort of an app that you opened up and you said what you were eating for dinner or whatever, but it was actually the corporatized public space. In the past, you would have bought a newspaper. Of course, we've seen Jeff Bezos, another tech oligarch who has done that and used it for his own purposes. This is what the industrialists always do. They take over the organs of communication. And what has happened on Twitter, and this is actually interesting, and I'm glad you brought up shadow banning. As somebody who he himself has been shadow banned, one of the things that I've noticed that has changed as Elon Musk has thrown in his weight behind Trump and this ticket with J.D. Vance. Immediately, weirdly enough, as soon as J.D. Vance got bought onto the ticket, I started to notice that this app would not let you post certain things or it would fail multiple times if you use certain keywords. I had to play around with that. There were times, over 36 times, where things would be rejected and there would be a quote-unquote error. What's funny, Pat, is that Twitter has done the exact same thing for China, India, Russia, other authoritarian nations. And what you actually find, if you look at the history and you go a little bit deeper than the surface, is that tech companies have always been happy to do the authoritarian footwork for authoritarians around the world. It just so happens that what has happened outside of our borders is now happening within our borders. And this actually is one of the largest threats that we've ever faced, because more or less what they believe and what they're trying to do is to change not only the consumption of news and information, but to use their predictive technologies and their algorithms, which oftentimes know us better than we know ourselves, in order to change culture and drag it backwards and create a reactionary neoconservative movement.
Are we as a country, Jared, at fault for giving guys like Musk and Peter Thiel and others so much power to begin with?
Undoubtedly. One of the biggest mistakes that we made, I want to put the onus where it belongs. This government did not understand tech. They were not interested in interrogating tech. They were not interested in regulating tech. The neoliberal consensus between the Democratic and the Republican Party led to that period of time around the turn of the century when all of a sudden they realized that this had the potential to make incredible amounts of money, this predictive technology, these algorithms, surveillance capitalism, you name it. And it's not only the Republicans, it was also the Democrats. And I want people to remember during the Barack Obama administration, they would have hearings on Capitol Hill with Zuckerberg, with Musk, you name it. And they would sit there and make heart eyes at them and draw, you know, like their initials on their notebooks, like they were in grade school. Like that entire point in time was where the regulation should have taken place. But the neoliberal consensus meant that they needed to outsource all of this. So what did they do? They allowed these tech overlords to basically get a foothold in the halls of power to amass historic wealth. And if anybody knows anything about history, and it goes back to the original corporations, the cycle works like this. The nation state uses the corporations to expand their power and their wealth. And eventually, in that process, through that outsourcing, the people who do that dirty work, they end up amassing so much wealth that they end up corrupting representative government and then essentially taking it over. If we learn from this, we can understand that, yes, our leaders are absolutely at fault. And the day to regulate this was years ago. And the best day to do it now is every single day that passes.
Well, I guess that leads to my last question here. I mean, I think that America is in this populist mood right now. We're not in the 90s, we're not in the 2000s, or even the Obama years, you know, the early 20-teens. That's why I think we're seeing unions, for instance, gaining some strength, that just as we're seeing with the UAW victory here against the big three Detroit automakers last fall. You know, I think people are understanding the failures of neoliberalism, and it's why people like Governor Whitmer here in Michigan or Tim Walz in Minnesota. I think it's why they're popular governors. I think people just want to know that their leaders are kind of looking out for them instead of corporations. So would you agree that this populist mood that the country is experiencing right now could really serve as a real blunt force to guys like Peter Thiel and Elon Musk if, let's say, somebody like Harris and the Democrats play it right this time?
Well, first of all, solidarity now, solidarity forever to all the unions making the gains. I have gotten a bit of a moniker of being a prophet of doom because I talk about this type of stuff. And let me tell you, it is not fun. It is scary. I understand that. But I have remained optimistic. And the reason is this: that populist spirit that you are talking about is absolutely at a boiling point right now. Watching the UAW become so aggressive, and Sean Fain deserves so much credit on that, and not just him, but the people underneath him. We're seeing, Pat, people with no experience, no training, are starting to unionize and win battles against some of the largest corporations that have ever existed. So a couple of things we need to keep in mind. One, this feeling that we're having right now with possibilities, it doesn't need to begin or end with Kamala Harris. She is a politician. We need to understand that Democratic small d pressures need to be exerted on these politicians. You know, politicians didn't wake up one day and decide we should have a 5-day work week or a 40-hour work week or that we should have all these things. It was forced upon them by the pressure of populist small d Democratic movements. I think there is a possibility for it. I believe in it. Humanity doesn't like this stuff. The question is whether or not an environment can be created that will fight those people. You know as well as I do that the history of labor power and solidarity is littered with blood. We're talking about labor unions in your backyard who fought literal wars against troops and private corporate detectives. They were murdered, they were slaughtered, they were held back, they were subterfuged. All of these movements that we now look back on with so much reverence and affection, they had to fight violence and they had to fight the entrenched power going after them. I do believe it's going to work out. but I do not want to give people false hope that it will in any way, shape, or form be easy or not messy.
Good place to leave it there. Jared Yates Sexton, thanks so much for being on Left of Lansing this week. I will provide a link to your article, What's Actually at Stake, MAGA and Tech Fascism, and also put a link to your Substack called Dispatches from a Collapsing State. Take care of yourself, and hey, keep speaking the truth to power, my friend. Great job.
Thanks, Pat.
A podcast devoted to intelligence, sanity, and freedom, or otherwise known as progressive politics. It's Left of Lansing with your host, Pat Johnston. Need to tell Pat where he's wrong? Or do you actually want to praise Pat? leftoflansing@gmail.com is how to reach him. Here's Pat.
My thanks again to Jared Yates Sexton for coming on to shine a light on the toxic tech fascist bros who are banking on Dear Leader and J.D. Vance to deliver their authoritarian wish list. And it should be noted that many in the tech industry also want to get rid of Federal Trade Commission Chair Lina Khan, and that includes LinkedIn founder and billionaire Democratic donor Reid Hoffman. You see, they don't like Khan's strong stance on antitrust cases, and they despise her strong stance for the working class consumer. Just want to make sure that you understand how toxic these tech bros are towards the rest of us. Time now for the Left of Lansing last call. Speaking of a victory for workers in Michigan, a victory that the people wanted, but MAGA Republicans blocked them from having for the last 6 years. The Michigan State Supreme Court ruled 4-3 this week that the then Republican legislature, with the help of nerd Rick Snyder, acted unconstitutionally to block minimum wage raises and new paid sick leave ballot initiatives from going into effect. This means starting in February of 2025, Michigan's minimum wage will rise to $12 and then it will be $15 by 2028. It also means that tipped wages for those in the service industry will see an increase until the tipped wages are completely phased out in a few years. On top of that, it also means that paid sick leave finally goes into effect, where employers with 10 people or less will have to offer up to 40 hours of paid sick leave per year, and employers with 10 or more workers will have to offer up to 72 paid sick leave days per year. Now, let's go back and remind ourselves why these benefits were delayed. The GOP-led legislature back in 2018 decided to adopt two ballot proposals, which qualified for the ballot after gaining signatures from hundreds of thousands of Michiganders, those being the $15 minimum wage and paid sick leave proposals. Now, this prevented us, the voters, from getting a chance to vote on the bills. MAGA Republicans against democracy? Hey, go figure, right? However, in lame duck session that year, these Republicans and Rick Snyder destroyed the original intent of these measures, all in the name to help their rich donor base. So they never meant to adopt the measures. They meant to blow them up and hurt working people. And the state Supreme Court ruling said, and I quote, "It is undisputed that under the Michigan Constitution, the legislature would not have been able to make these amendments by simple majority vote if the initiatives had appeared on the ballot and had been approved by a majority of Michigan voters in the 2018 election. Rather, the legislature chose a path not set forth in the Constitution. It adopted the proposed laws as written on the initiative petitions and then amended those laws as soon as the election was over." So you see, the Supreme Court here, the state Supreme Court, ruled the Republican move was a ploy and was an undemocratic attempt to overrule what the people wanted. So it's unconstitutional. And this is a moment to be celebrated, everyone. This is great. So many times it seems like workers are getting the shaft. Not this time. Although, get ready. Get ready for the expected freakout by business lobbyists, Republicans, and sadly, a Democrat here and there, to be honest. A Michigan Restaurant and Lodging Association September 2022 survey said that 91% of restaurant owners reported that they would raise their prices, and 58% said that they would end up laying off workers if these two ballot initiatives went into effect. Snyder's former lieutenant governor, Brian Kelly, who leads the Small Business Association of Michigan, declares that this ruling will destroy businesses. Well, here's the thing. I don't see it that way. Restaurant prices have already been going up ever since the pandemic. People still seem to be going. Places still seem to be open. And to still be paying service workers around $3 an hour is just unconscionable. Plus, this might also have the effect of bringing in more people to work for said businesses. And as Sarah Mae Seward, who's running for Matt Maddox's state house seat, said last week, and she's been working in the service industry for a few decades, she says it's hard for workers to rely on tipped wages on a daily basis. And as Sarah tweeted in response to this ruling, she said the people of Michigan voted for this measure. In fact, they believe it's already in effect. As a bartender, people are confused when they realize where $3.93 per hour when they voted and passed equal minimum wage. They're already tipping accordingly. And Sarah also points out that the National Restaurant Association is the same lobbying group that owns the company that bartenders and servers have to pay in order to be certified to work for a sub-minimum wage. And here's my quick take. A living wage is something we should all be celebrating. This means servers aren't relying on the whims of the customer. I'm fine with maybe trying to find some middle ground on certain issues and discuss some issues and solutions, whatever. But to say that it's wrong for workers to earn a living wage is the wrong message, and not one Democrat should be saying that. This will help so many workers and also make Michigan become even more attractive for those trying to grow the state. It's another example of MAGA Michigan Republicans showing you that their so-called populism stance is an outright fake and outright sham. And let this also serve as a reminder how important our state Supreme Court elections are, which is why you have to vote for Kira Harris-Bolden and Kimberly Thomas this November.
You're listening to the Left of Lansing podcast. The music you're hearing is by Wander Beats. To hear the latest project, check out Space Leopard on your favorite streaming site. Now back to our favorite progressive voice in Michigan, it's Pat Johnston.
Well, that's going to do it for this awesome edition of The Left of Lansing. I do want to let you know that at the time of this recording, the United Auto Workers announced its endorsement of Vice President Kamala Harris for president. Of course, it had previously endorsed President Biden. The UAW President Sean Fain said, and I quote, "We can put a billionaire back in office who stands against everything our union stands for, or we can elect Kamala Harris, who will stand shoulder to shoulder with us in our war on corporate greed." Well said. Well said, President Fain. And as I said earlier, Harris will apparently appear with her new VP pick in Detroit next week to rally with UAW workers and thousands of other working Michiganders. Don't forget, please don't forget to tell everyone you know that Dear Leader Trump is nothing but a freaking scab. He refused to show up and stand in solidarity with the UAW last fall and has spent his entire professional life trying to destroy unions. He ain't a union man, and he doesn't care about the working people of the state. He's a scab. He's a pro-management, and he's a pro-billionaire scab. He's no populist. He works, as you just heard, to help those already in powerful positions to gain even more power to hold all of us down. Special thanks to Jared Yates Sexton for sharing his work on the tech oligarchs and why they're backing MAGA. And special thanks to Michigan Advance's Susan Demas for being on to offer her expertise when it comes to anything Michigan politics. And I am still hoping that Harris ends up picking Whitmer, by the way. Next week, my good friend from Distill Social and the Social Disorder Podcast, Gina Keller, will join me to break down their big anti-Project 2025 rally that happened across the state last week. And we'll talk about what kinds of messaging that we have to do to ensure that Michigan remains part of the blue wall of resistance against MAGA this November. Until next week, remember, take the battle to them. Thank you, Michigan!
The Left of Lansing podcast was produced by Pat Johnston, written by Pat Johnston, researched by Pat Johnston, edited by Pat Johnston, and hosted by, yes, Pat Johnston. Technical assistance by Dr. Heather. And thanks to our good friend Kirsten for the awesome podcast logo. Remember to visit leftoflansing.com for more news and information. Thanks again for listening to the Left of Lansing podcast.